and welcome to minute 91 of season 10 of Movie Room Minute, the daily podcast where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller The Taking of Pelham 123 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me is Niall McGowan of the Bat Minute. Welcome back, Niall.
Hello, Rob. Are you a podcaster? I'm also slightly troubled now because the instant you started that, there's a window cleaner has come. And I'm now looking at a brush scrubbing the window in front of me, which was completely unexpected.
You should be very scared if he's going to pull out a gun.
Yeah. That just reminded me one time I was doing like a therapy session, and then I kept having to interrupt it because someone I lived with was having bags of soil delivered. And I was just trying to explain to the therapist, just like, yeah, some like he's ringing the doorbell. I'm trying to ignore him, but he's just looking in at me, like pointing at the soil bags and saying I have to come sign for them. I was like, dude, just go away. So like, and if, you know, it happens once. Guy came back like 10 minutes later and did the same thing. Like, oh my God. Yeah, but anyway, that's nothing to do with the taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Because he had a lot of soil. Now, if you would have come with bags of money, would you have opened it quicker?
Well, yeah, it depends if they were like, untraceable bills, the mixed serial numbers, all that stuff,
Okay.
And it was, because they have to divide up in the bags of, $50,000 in, $10 bills or like whatever the whole spiel.
Half a million dollars in 50s and $500,000 in 100. That's what it is. Non-sequential, bills.
Stacked
by using with elastic thick, band. Too thick elastic.
It specifies thick to like as if that's a very like I do admire the fact everything does seem to be like planned down to the letter. Whereas like he probably has thought through like if it's thin elastic bands they won't hold properly, so it has to be thick. He's nothing if not organized. This guy.
Yeah. That there is no question about that.
Yeah. But okay, we'll get to him in due time,
We shall. Okay, so minute 91 begins with the passengers continuing to panic and ends with Blue asking a question. So we're getting towards the end of this. We're trying to figure out what's going on here. Mr. Green is already on his way onto the stairs. We see that the passengers are trying to find some sort of hope because one of them screams out, there has to be, meaning there has to be a red light at some point. It's all green lights coming along. And
so again, it wasn't until like researching for the podcast, because I've seen this film, dozens of times and stuff, but I hadn't realized that none of the subway passengers have any names. So he's just down as the old man. And there's a guy down as like the pimp. And there's someone down as, like the mother and stuff like that. And it's like,
The hooker, the nurse, the secretary.
Which I guess, I don't know if that's, I'm sure, you probably, because we're that late into the film, you probably talked about all this already. But like, I can't help but feel that's like, it's designed in some way to mirror the hijackers themselves because like, they don't have any names, as because it is Blue, Mr. Green, all this stuff. Then it's like the irony is like the flip of it is like, oh yeah, no, the victims don't even have any. Like within these circumstances, they're just like the hijackers and they have these names that aren't real names. And then like, oh yeah, and then the hostages themselves don't have any. They're just like, designated token sort of like, yep, that one's the alcoholic, that one's the old man, that kind of thing as well. But
so you're saying they
maybe in the book.
They should have given them colors, the woman with the beige jacket should just be known as Miss Beige.
Miss Beige, like, yeah, why not? Or I don't know, maybe like my only beef with the whole movie. This is stuff that'll be more relevant for like a minute further down the week. But is that like, yeah, I wouldn't mind if they had like fleshed out the hostages a bit more and kind of given them a bit more to do, maybe or maybe give them names for instance, but. Because at one point I was just like, you have the hippie, who's the undercover cop, but then who is in this minute? So hey, But then I was thinking, like, oh, the lady sitting trying to get, trying to will the train at the stop. It's like, my assumption would be that, well, she's a hippie. Like, she's the one trying to, oh, this is all stuff for like a minute further on. So put a pin in that.
She's
Put
known
a
as
pin in my beef with the.
she's co-ed number one or number two. I don't remember which one she is. And I think we talked about it that she's the wife of one of the one of the producers or the or so, she's the wife of somebody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, every
But I think the reason that we don't have to have names for the passenger for the, all the hostages is because none of them does anything inconsequential. You can switch any of them out with someone else. It's not as if they do something special. The one thing that they tried doing with all of these 17 hostages is make us guess which one of them is the cop. That's it. They have nothing else that makes them significant.
I think that's and that's a it's an element that's so kind of like downplayed to me as well, that like when the guy does jump up and goes like, "Hey, I'm a cop," I was like, "Oh yeah," I forgot that that was supposed to be a thing as well. But.
Well, again, I think part of the joke is also that we don't need to know who the cop is because it doesn't matter. There was nothing he could do until he reaches this point, and then he jumps off the train and gets injured. That really helps.
Yeah. But I wasn't too sure though if they're trying to do like a mirroring thing though. I've been like, well, all parties involved in this, none of them have any real identities that we can cling on to. They're all just sort of like chess pieces in this sort of scenario. And it's the only people with any real personalities you get though are like, the transit guys and the mayor and stuff like that as well. But
Okay, but again, I think that's on purpose because we don't need to focus on them. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who any of them truly are, because it won't change anything. If you can change out the old man and have an old woman instead, or change I don't know the hooker and it's a teenager. It doesn't really matter. They were able to give each of them a little bit of a line here or there, okay. But most of their lines are basically crybabying, trying to, maybe you should let me go. Like when the hooker says, "I have an important, I have an appointment, an important appointment I got to make," and we all can figure out what type of appointment that must be. But it adds to the humorous aspects of it, and that's it. But it's not as if the plot pins at all on what these occupations are of these people, which is why it doesn't really make a difference. The color idea, we know is a great idea to have them all refer to each other as the colors, so that this way, for the to conceal their identities. And Tarantino loved it so much he used it in Reservoir Dogs. Again, in the first movie, that's the thing he takes from this. So I think
I
that's
think
great.
the this movie kind of has like the code names mean more as well to me, like, because Mr. White in Reservoir Dogs, like, oh, I guess he's like the white hat because he's like, he's one of the more righteous of the crew. But then after Mr. Pink been called Mr. Pink's kind of like, well, it's more of a joke for the purposes of making a joke in the film, et cetera, et cetera. But in this, it's just like, well, Mr. Blue is like, well, he's kind of like, he's the more educated, he seems more refined, he's a bit more, he comes and because he's English, he comes across a bit more like, oh, like a blue blood kind of thing. Like, he's got a bit of a, an upper crust kind of vibe about him. Mr. Green is literally sick during it. People assume, people
And
associate
also,
greenness with sickness and
and
stuff.
also, Green is someone who doesn't have experience. He's not a
Yeah, well, there
criminal.
you go. So, and then Mr. Gray is, of course, like, well, you don't know, you can't trust him. Like, you literally have no idea what's gonna happen with him because he's just so morally dubious that not even his own crew trust him. So he's Mr. Gray, things like that. So I think, like, yeah, it's they've thought it through for this,
And
whereas Tarantino, I
Mr.
feel.
Brown is Mr.
Yep. Mr. Sh the bed. But yeah, and I think, yeah. And again, it's not to knock Tarantino, but I don't know if there's a reason Mr. Orange is Mr. Orange. Like, it's a very distinct sort of, you know, name to give him. But, like, it's just very much like, yeah, but, you know, he's an undercover cop. And what does Orange got to do with, you know, what's that got to do with anything? Like, why is Mr. Blonde
peel,
Mr. Blonde?
Maybe you have to peel, you have to get beyond the peel in order to know who you're really dealing with. I don't know.
No, like, potentially, Mr. Blonde then would be like, but you think, you maybe I'm thinking too, like, simply, would be like, you know, Mr. Red or something would be, you know, for, like, blood. It would be more associated with him. But maybe there's an idea of, like, well, why Mr. Blonde in particular? Because, well, you know, so he's a psychopath, but, like, what's that got to do with blonde? Like, what's the... Right. Is it because, like, you know, an icy blonde, like a femme fatale kind of thing they're trying to go for? Like, what's... This is not Reservoir Dogs minute by minute. It is, in fact, the taking of Bellum 1, 2, 3.
Right, but you know what? You brought me to a question that I've asked almost every one of my my guests, or maybe even all of them, over mm-hmm. this entire season. Do you think that Mr. Blue put this whole thing together, or is this like a Reservoir Dogs situation where there is someone above him, like a Joe or Marcellus Wallace or something like that, who planned the whole thing and put these guys together to do the work?
It's a good question. But because I think they do mention dividing the money up into, like, quarters, I think, which would indicate more it's like, well, whoever planned it wouldn't be profiting that way, which would make me assume that it must be Mr. Blue putting it together. But every other indication is like he's a mercenary, he's a guy for hire, and he has no regard for Mr. Gray, and it's all like, yeah, well, why would you? Like, why would a mercenary between wars be like, you know what, I'm going to hijack the subway train and I'm going to get these random guys in to help me? It doesn't make any real... I suppose you could make sense of it if you wanted to sort of extrapolate that and
headcanon.
But
I can explain the way that they split the money into four. Okay, they do mention, in I think it was yesterday's minute, Mr. Blue says to Mr. Green, you know, I'll meet you where we said we would meet. So the idea is, okay, yeah. Let's all, we're each going to carry a quarter of the money. We're going to get to, the abandoned warehouse waiting for Joe, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then we're going to give all the money to Joe and then everyone will get their cut.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it's not as if they're saying, okay, this is your cut, run and, have a nice day.
Yeah. I guess that kind of is what ends up happening.
that's something else. And again, we'll see later this week that Mr. Green does have almost entirely all of Mr. Gray's money on him.
I think that would be intriguing if you wanted to extrapolate that, like, not, you know, God, heaven forbid that we try to make a sequel or anything like that. But yeah, it's curious that, like, you know, you wonder if even in the days that follow the film, if Garber would even be like, well, did, you know, is it just these four, is it these random four guys we're dealing with? Or do I have to start now investigating, like, who is this other entity? Because it does make more sense for it to be that, like, oh yeah, so you bring in, it'd be someone going like, I've compiled these four people to come in together to be like, well, Mr. Blue is obviously a guy who can take charge and he is a mercenary and we know he's ruthless and he will do what needs to be done. He's the perfect guy to lead this. Mr. Green obviously has his experience. Mr. Gray's good muscle, et cetera, et cetera. Mr. Brown is also there.
Also muscle.
Also muscle. Back muscles that don't end up failing them at the end.
Right.
But like, yeah, it would make a lot more sense if it was, a fifth outside entity putting this together. But yeah, it's curious that they never really allude to that, though. You just sort of take it on face value that it's Mr. Blue is just so, because he is such a dominant figure,
right?
That must be him. But then it doesn't make much logical sense that if they've established that he's a guy for hire, then why would he put this together by himself off his own back
and
with people he doesn't seem to really know?
Exactly. Why wouldn't he take people that he trusts to be able to do
it? Yeah. Surely he would have, through various war zones, you know, previous people he soldiered with.
Right.
And they would be more trustworthy than a guy they... I think it's the potentially the cheesiest line of the whole movie of, you know, they threw him out of the mafia, which is very, like... I don't think they throw people out of the mafia. I think it's like, if they want rid of you, they'll kill you. Because if they throw you out, then you're a liability. So I thought that was a very, like... It's almost like a kid's understanding of, like, oh, the mafia, oh, they're badass. But, like, this guy's so badass that they threw him out. It's like, the mafia doesn't go, like, yeah, you're not allowed to sit with us anymore. Like,
and this,
they'll actively
out.
Just kill you.
And this movie comes out at the time of The Godfather. You know, so...
Yeah. There's like, all right, Mr. Gray, you have to go. You're not allowed to sit with us anymore. But you're not going to tell anybody anything, right? We can trust you to just keep your mouth shut and walk away and keep the peace, right? It's like, oh, yeah, sure. That's trustworthy.
I think that's what Michael Corleone would have told him, but he would have eventually, you know, found a way for Mr. Gray to have a little bit of an accident somewhere along the line. And Mr. Gray is sleeping with the fishes.
But I also get to, like, from in The Godfather, they would be all like, oh, yeah, that's like, no problem, Michael. And as soon as they're out the door, like, oh, shit, he's going to kill me. Like, they would understand that it's all, like, surface level. They don't literally go, like, pink slip. Like, you know, we've run out of, you know, you're a hard worker, Mr. Gray, but unfortunately, we don't have the space for you anymore. Right. So we're going to have to go with them. I was actually in Sicily last month. And one of the big things I was reading in the news is apparently organized crime is still a thing. Like, they're going around saying, like, no, there's no mafia, there's no mafia, there's no mafia. And then the police investigations are like, there is a mafia. It's rebranded. It's called, like, the Black Axe now. But their big problem is they can't get the staff, apparently. There's, like, literally a news report saying organized crime down because there's no one wants to do it anymore.
Well, because nobody wants to, you know, be sleeping with the fishes.
Yeah. And or whatever, made such a bad PR campaign after so many years. But yeah, literally was just like Don's going like, yeah, we want people, but like we can't get anything organized because, like, you know there's just no staff around it anymore. No one's willing to come in to do the overtime to be a gangster these days, unfortunately.
Interesting.
But there you go. If anyone's looking for some employment, go over to Sicily. Apparently, they're hiring in the mafia / Black Axe over there currently. So,
right.
And I've not seen anything in films or media to indicate that would be a bad decision to join the mafia. It seems like it's only ever an uphill thing. So, you know. To be fair, I've never watched the end of any of the films that feature gangsters. I always turn off when everything... It always seems like midway through, everything's going great for everyone. And I'm like, oh, yeah, story's over. So, yeah, I'll just walk away at that point.
Exactly. All right, so then we get a shot of Mr. Green climbing up the stairs in order to try and get out from the subway. And, you know, lifts up the grate, which my assumption is the grate must be a little heavier than you would think. I mean, we talked about it back during Die Hard 3, that those grates must be much heavier than the way it seems, but maybe not. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I know those circular, like, sewer lids, like the turtles sewer lids that I was associated them with. I know they're like a ton. Like, they are, because they're designed to be. Like, they have to be, because otherwise people will just steal them. Which I think something like this might be a little lighter because, like, it's all sort of attached and welded in.
No, but it's also this is a maintenance entrance type of thing. You can't make it impossible for a maintenance guy to get there if he needs to, I guess.
Yeah. But you never know. Like, Martin Balsam might be just such a strong athletic figure that he's able to lift that without any. That was weird, actually, to me. In Watch, because he's got a. Yeah, I like his hat. I like his coat and stuff. But in my mind, I don't know, maybe I'm getting mixed up with one of the remakes or something. But in my head, I thought they all changed into maintenance worker stuff. Like, that was my memory, my mind's eye was like, oh yeah, their whole scheme was then that they were going to dress as maintenance workers because people wouldn't question it if they seen these guys coming out, which is like That is apparently a thing that they even today, you know, criminals will advise that as a thing to do, is like, if you go in somewhere with a high-vis jacket and like a hard hat, most people will just look the other way because they assume like, oh, it's like a maintenance person. There's someone here to do something. If someone comes in with a high-vis jacket and like a giant torch or something, or like a toolkit, people are gonna be like, okay, nothing out of the ordinary there then. You know, they'll just automatically trust
True. I
it.
mean, that's what people do in most movies. They dress up as a cop, they dress up as a maintenance man, and nobody pays any attention to them.
Yeah, but for some reason in my mind's eye, like I have a visual of like Robert Shaw in a blue jumpsuit, like stuffing stacks of money down into it. Like, yeah, it's like his boiler suit to be like, oh yeah, he's just like a janitor or whatever, or like a, you know, subway worker. And then like when I watch it this time, it's like, oh no, they're just full on just turning into like, it's kind of like their first outfits, only different, you know. So I was like, oh, it's weird that I completely misremembered that. But yeah, I've not seen like the Vincent D'Onofrio one in long, long, long time. So maybe they do it in that, and that's I'm getting them mixed up or something. But yeah, they do. Or maybe I was just like, it would make more like internally. I was like, it would make way more sense for them to do that, because this does like, you know, there's dozens of people around them. Mr. Green's emerging, and I think someone would be like, that's weird that this like middle-aged to old man in a furry, you know, hat and a coat just came out of the like a sewer
If
maintenance
I remember
hatch.
correctly, he was like 48 at the time.
Oh man.
Exactly.
That's like I'm only 10 years off Mr. Green. That's what you're telling me. Oh my God.
I'm 3 years above. And,
Wow. Oh boy. But well, you know, 70s New York. It was a harsh mistress, I guess.
right, let's see. Balsam was born in 1919. No, sorry. He was 50. He was 50, 54, 55 at this point, but still.
Okay,
No, but he's
that's a
still.
bit more it's a bit more acceptable, but like it's a bit like, oh boy, I think in modern standards he looks like, I'll tell you actually, while I was watching something quite recently, this is relevant, I'll have to send you the link to it if you've not brought it up in the show already, but I saw a thing with one of Robert Shaw's sons, and he looks great. I was, you know, looking at him, I'll be like, oh yeah, he must be like 40 or something. And then he would talk
No,
about like, yeah, when I was a
he can't be
teenager,
40
me.
because his father died almost 50 years ago.
Well, that's what I mean. In this interview, he talks about like playing golf with him when he was a teenager, and I was like, but he died in like 78. So I looked up this guy. He's like, yeah, and Robert Shaw's son's like 63. He looks maybe 40, and you're like, Jesus Christ, like that's amazing genes there, I guess, but yeah, it's just, you know, different standard of living nowadays too. I guess, you know, people are so the people look younger for longer, I guess, is the thing. Whereas like back in 74, Martin Balsam, if you turned around and said like, oh yeah, he's 42, people will be like, yeah, that's, you know, he's lived a life, you know. We all go through it, you know.
I mean, Shaw was 47 when they made this movie.
And it's the let's go. I keep trying to make some try to round Martin Balsam back to some sort of balsamic vinegar joke. I'm just like, I gotta make a balsamic vinegar joke at some point. So I was gonna be like, maybe it's a lifetime of living on the vinegar or something like that. But then I was like, I don't think this is gonna land. I think this balsamic vinegar bit is a potential dead end, unfortunately.
Yeah, sounds like it.
If anyone can think of any good Martin Balsam balsamic vinegar bits that we could come up with throughout the rest of the week, please do write in to the show.
So, Mr. Green then gets out onto the street and starts walking a little suspiciously, and then moves his hat a little bit, and then just goes with the flow. And as he's walking away, we see the police car pull up with Garber Daniels and Daniels' driver. The three of them all get out of the car. And Daniels then says, "We got to bottle up the emergency exits." And then Garber turns to him and goes, "Inspector, you take the 15th Street. Officer, you take the 17th Street," which I guess I assume that means that they're at the 16th Street. So what Garber's basically saying is, you go one back that way, you go one back that way, and I'm going to just stay right here.
Well, you know, like Walter Matthau, he's an old man himself. He's got to think about his own stamina.
Again, he's also in his early 50s.
Yeah. But think of the fair that Walter Matthau was born in his early 50s. So, I think that's sort of his default setting, really.
That's true. And then he goes over to the grate exactly where Mr. Green has just gone through. Do you think Green saw them? You think he sees them show up or anything like that? Or he's just not paying attention to what's going on. He wants to be as inconspicuous as possible.
I think he's probably like in that scenario. What I would be like, if you heard the siren and stuff, you would assume, but you would like try not to panic. So he's probably aware. He's probably freaking out, thinking like, yeah, they're right behind me. But he's also might be like, well, it's New York. There could be a dozen sirens going off for any number of
Because
reasons. I gotta just keep my head down and keep on going,
they
you
do
know?
give us a shot of him quickly turning around as he's walking.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. He's probably, yeah, he might literally be like, oh boy, that was a close one. Because, because you'd be really, really, he is the master of playing it cool under pressure, as we do see later on. So, yeah, maybe him just gonna quick glance back and been able to sort of just keep his composure is just perfectly within character for Mr. Green. But yeah, I imagine that he probably does have a little bit of a cold sweat going on, like, oh man, that was too close, you know.
And then he just keeps walking, and then we see Garber begin to descend the stairs. But Garber actually smartly leaves the grate open, as he's walking down. I guess maybe to let everyone know that he's the one who's there. And then the shot changes, and we see the hippie policeman who was shot by Blue. Writhing on the ground.
I will say too, like in the shots of Garber going down, because you see a bunch of random New York detritus, you know, sort of around there. You get like a purple and cream ice cream van, which I thought was quite striking. And one, it's only half the sign, but you do see in the background at one point a sign that just says garbage.
Yes.
It's very much like all films and TV have shown me about New York in the 70s. It's just like, yeah, trash strewn hellhole. I just like the idea that they literally just have a big sign up just promoting garbage. It's just like, come and get it. It's
Right.
everywhere.
My
Garbage.
assumption is that there's probably more that's written on the sign, but yeah.
Yeah. They're just like, we might as well try to spin it into a positive, though. It's like, it is everywhere, but just revel in it. Garbage. Come on. You'll love
That's
it.
right.
Yeah. This guy went now,
I'm trying
like,
to
I've
read
never
what
been
it
to New
says.
York, but.
I'm trying to read what the entire sign says. Police, sanitation, something, garbage. I think
Yeah.
that's what it says.
The police.
It looks like that's what it says.
It's probably like another sign against the mayor. It's probably like under Mayor Borg, the police and sanitation department are garbage. Because yeah, I think we'll get to the mayor in due time. But I do love our interconnected
Yes.
between podcasts, you know, mayoral connection. And in my headcanon, I like to think that it's literally the same man. But yeah, this the I've never been to New York, and I almost feel now that I'd be disappointed in it if it wasn't literally hell on earth, because I've been made to think that that's what it is by so many things. It's like, oh yeah, it's a perpetually, it always seems to be cold. It always seems to be just nighttime most of the time, and everything is covered in grim hot garbage juice everywhere. And everyone's miserable and hates each other. I'm like, yes, New York. If you can make it there. But now I understand apparently it's quite nice there. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'd go, if I had the chance to.
And then we get the great David Charm music for a few seconds, moments, as Mr. Blue gets closer to the policeman on the ground, and he goes, "Are you a policeman?" And then
It's
the minute
a
ends.
yeah. The David Shire music is like a really it's allowed the let us Freak Flag Fly this minute. Like, they really go full tilt into just the whole suite getting the kick in.
Seriously.
That's a good David Chow's, like, I hadn't actually looked into him all that much prior to this. But it's a great distinct score. But I just enjoyed, like, did this, this, and this, and this. Apocalypse Now, brackets rejected. And you're like, oh wow, what happened there? And it's more like, it wasn't so much rejected as just like Apocalypse Now had a hellish schedule and they couldn't quite make it work, so he had to walk away from it. And then Coppola got his dad to do the score. And of this, like, because you can get David Shire's Apocalypse Now score on YouTube now, it's just
Well, no,
sat there for
that
free.
probably also maybe has to do with the fact that Coppola's sister, Talia Shire, was maybe she already got divorced from David Shire at that point, or there
Well,
could be
maybe
family politics here. I'm not,
it could be. It could be.
I'm not 100%
Yeah,
sure.
I think the vibe I got from it was, it seemed like there's a little article written about it saying, like, I think that it's only really been discovered recently, where someone was like interviewing him in his home, and there was like they came across all his old tapes, and he's like they had like Apocalypse Now written on it. And he's like, what's that? And he's like, oh yeah, I did a score for Apocalypse Now that they never used, and it's all electronic. Which the thing is, though, listening to it on the stuff that's available, I'm like, it sounds very similar to what ended up in the film anyway. So I don't know if it was, like, yeah, maybe it was a divorce thing, or it might have just been like, he's gone. I think it's put down to being scheduling conflicts.
Well, come on, they're
But
not going to
like,
say, my wife and I were having problems, and my brother-in-law decided he didn't want to use me anymore. I mean, that according to IMDb, they got divorced on May 9th, 1980. But and Apocalypse Now came out in 79, but as anyone knows, people don't get divorced within a day. It's something that is gradual, hopefully.
You never know, it might be coming at this backwards too, and it was more like the reason they got divorced is because Francis Coppola is like, yeah, I'm not going to use your score anymore. And then he was just constantly bugging Talia to be like, come on, get him to put my music in, get him to put it back in. Why is your brother such a jerk, Talia? And then he's like, that's it, I can't stand the two of you fighting anymore. I'm getting a divorce. You two can't ever see each other again. But yeah, you go so it's like Apocalypse Now score, rejected. Da, 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 da. Homeward Bound score, rejected. I was like, there's no story behind that one. I was like, what's this guy? Like, it's, one rejected score is shame on you. But like, two rejected scores is shame on me. So I don't know if he also got married to like one of the dog owners from Homeward Bound or something, and then they're like, oh no, there's another divorce incoming. He's like, god damn it.
You never know.
Or maybe he, yeah, or he just lazed out and he's just like, oh yeah, here's my score for Homeward Bound. And it was just like 3 hours of like really atmospheric, ominous synth music, the sounds of, capturing the nightmarish landscape of the Vietnam War. And they're like, did you write this for Homeward Bound? You didn't write this for like something else? And he's like, nope, that's 100%. And then they're like, no, we can't use this, man. He's like, all right, putting the Apocalypse Now score back in the box then, I guess. Just I'll flog it to somebody someday. Damn it.
Exactly. All right. So, because today's a Saturday and we don't have a normal segment for Saturday, but Niall was not with us yesterday on Friday. So today we're going to do Fun City Friday, the segment which my guests will give their top five movies that take place in New York or are connected to New York or something to that fact. So, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, so I'll go with it's one of those ones that once you start going down this rabbit hole, there's so you're just like, I was trying to go for ones that are more like, well, New York is a as a character within, the old cliche of like, oh, it's a character within the text itself kind of thing. So I'm gonna go number five, would be Party Girl. Of course, remember from 1995, Party Girl, with Parker Posey, etc., etc. Was, it kind of captures the mood and vibe of 90s New York in particular. And of course, he ends up working in the public library. I now work in the Liverpool Public Library, so it's a little it's a little shout out there, between cities, on my behalf. But also, yeah, it really captures, like, it captures a moment in time too, but it's also capturing a moment in time in that particular city. And then I'm gonna do a cheeky double, if I can, for number four. In that, I'm putting Taxi Driver slash After Hours. I'm giving you a Scorsese double because I think it's kind of part of a. I've him and hawing about putting King of Comedy in as well because that's also set in New York, but that doesn't feel more as about it being a New York movie. Whereas Taxi Driver and After Hours are very much like Scorsese on New York, in particular. I suppose you could also say Mean Streets in there too because that's very much like the film's literally titled after the streets of the thing. But I feel like you can't do.
So in other words, you just want to you Martin Scorsese's view
Yeah.
of New York.
Of that era too, because again, you can go gangs in New York, but that's a different New York. Like that's a whole other, it's a whole other entity, basically. But yeah, like that.
Well, I'm just gonna give Taxi Driver points for it, but I understand the vibe.
Although I really want to, After Hours is just a very underrated film too. It's just a very just. Very odd. Like I'm assuming you've seen After Hours, but it's just such like a such an odd, undersung Scorsese piece. And it almost because I kind of felt like, oh, Taxi Driver will get all the accolades from other people. Well, I wanted to be like, well, After Hours deserves its flowers, because that is all about New York. It's literally a guy stuck out in the wandering the entire city for an entire evening. But at the same time, it's just like, yeah, but Taxi Driver is Taxi Driver though. Like it's like the ultimate, isn't. Isn't the city awful? Kind of a vibe, Another one I'm gonna go for is just a generally underrated film. In general, I'm gonna go for 200 Cigarettes. I don't know if you've ever come across 200 Cigarettes. Well,
Yeah, of course.
yeah. So yeah, but it still never got its renaissance. Like I remember it got dumped on at the time. And over years, people are still like, "Oh yeah, 200 Cigarettes. What a disaster that film is." And I love it. Like it's every other New Year's, I will watch 200 Cigarettes because it's all set like a, a composite cast of just like wildly different characters, all in New York on New Year's Eve, in the 70s, just trying to, hook up and make dates. And oh, it's not the 70s, in the 80s because I think yeah, Martha Plimpton's character is very very 80s based. But or maybe it's literally 1979. I think actually is the newest. It's the turn of the decade. I think, and yeah, I think it's a really underrated film. Also available on YouTube for free, much like David Shire's Apocalypse Now score. But it was one of those ones that me and my friend Lauren have developed a thing now. Whereas you always get the Criterion Closet where all the celebs show up and pretend that they like 9.5 or 8.5. 9.5 weeks or 8.5 by Fellini, way more than they probably do. And you got like Elle Fanning coming in, been like, "Oh, I love the Czech surrealist film Daisies." It's like you've never seen Daisies in your life, lady. But we've got our flip to it now is the YouTube urinal, which is like the opposite of the Criterion glasses, where it's just, everything is available on YouTube for free. So most of it's all stuff like Subspecies 4 and things like that. But the odd time you get a genuine gem pops up in there, and 200 Cigarettes is one of them. You can just watch that for free on YouTube now. As can you watch Party Girl, weirdly enough, even though that's like a celebrated classic. It's also now it's got Spanish subtitles under it, but it's on YouTube for free. And then like my final two are they're a bit more obvious, but they're a bit more, and they're. Some people might go like, "Oh, come on, you have to throw in like Manhattan or something like that," but like I'm going to, for me, when I think of New York, the two films I think of immediately are Ghostbusters 2 in particular, because even the first one's a very New York film, but Ghostbusters 2 is all like literally the whole the end of the nemesis in the film is utilizing the city's hatred of everything of all the people around it. To create this, this pink slime and stuff. And it's like it's very, very much about the state of New York, and it said a lot to me as a kid to be like, the concept that like the heroes will be getting sued by the city, and that's the way. That's a thing that could literally happen, is because like, oh yeah, people are assholes, and this is the way the world works and stuff. And that always really stuck with me is like, has been a quintessentially New York type of thing. It's like, even though at the end they go into a positive spin, of course, where they get the Statue of Liberty and all that happens, and it's like, look, you can unite all the people, and it turns into, Raimi Spider-Man, where it's like, yeah, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, in my head, Ghostbusters 2 in particular, very New York film. And then number one, film close to your own heart, Rob, Die Hard with a Vengeance, I think is the best of the New York. Well, I think it's just my personal favorite. I don't think it's the best films at New York. But it's my personal favorite ones in that, like, I just love that they extrapolated from guy trapped in a building, guy trapped on a plane, or a family trapped on a plane, guy trapped in the airport. And then to be like, what if literally the city of New York was, that's where he's trapped. And they really utilize it by, like all the stuff going through the park. And they, the vibe of the people he's having to interact with, and all the thickness of the accents at times too. Like, me and my friends still will like throw in like, oh, it's a Christmas, you can steal City Hall, and like all that kind of stuff. And it's like, it's very, very like, Die Hard with a Vengeance lives and breathes on being a New York film to me. And yeah, of all the ones presented there, it's the one I would always want to watch if given the option. I'll be like, yeah, put that on. That's a phenomenal film. So yeah. I don't know. You get the kind of ooh there, Rob, as if you're like, oh, don't even. Like, I know we covered it, but like, get out of here with that.
No, I'm happy to see it's on your list.
Yeah. I don't know how many of those. Like, I don't know if Die Hard with a Vengeance is making many appearances there, but. In other people's lists, but like, for me, it's very much like, I mean, literally the opening shots or establishing
Remember
shots of the city
the
to be like, yep, this is where this is our Nakatomi Plaza for the evening. It's going to be the entire city
Or,
of New York.
well, let's put it this way. You have now managed to help Die Hard with a Vengeance get a slot in every single one of the five slots.
Wow. Also, it's.
Meaning one person has it as number five, one person number four, one is number three, one is number two, and you have it as number one. So
Yeah.
there you go.
No, nice. Nice. I'm happy to give it
Completed
that.
the
Happy to
set.
be able to put that crown on its head. Yeah, I don't even know technically if I was to go through. It's like, is it the best of the films that's on there? But I think it's a personal thing. It's just my favorite. I'll be like, oh yeah. If anyone ever mentioned to me, films set in New York, my mind would immediately go to like, oh yeah, Die Hard 3. Yeah, because it just clicks into
Perfect.
place for me. So, but yeah, there you go.
Perfect. All right. Now we will play the daily game of Name That Remake, where I will randomly get a name of a movie that was remade, and I'm going to give you clues, and you have to try and guess what movie it is.
All right.
So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. Around and around and around the wheel goes.
That wheel's still going, huh?
Okay, this is an interesting one. This is going to be an interesting one, because I'm going to give you a hint. There's another movie that constantly references all of these movies,
Oh.
because this is a movie that was originally made in 1939 and was remade in 1957 and in 1994.
Okay.
But there is a movie from 1993 that constantly refers to it. Which is very, very funny. Okay, and it's about a man and a woman who fall in love, but due to the distance between them, they're not able to be together. So they decide that they're going to because they're both engaged to other people, and they decide that they're both going to get their lives in order, and they will meet again in 3 months. To prove that their love still lasts. Do you have
Oh,
any idea what this movie may be?
wow. When you gave the dates, I was like, oh, it's Little Women. Of course, it's Little Women. And now I'm like, oh, God damn it. I'm pretty sure that's not what Little Women's about.
I would have also said, was it 20, 2019, 2020, when there was another Little Woman afterwards.
Yeah. Oh, of course, yeah. Because it was also thinking like A Star Is Born, maybe. It's like, no, but they just brought one out the other year. So,
That was also 20, I think 2018 was the latest A Star Is Born, I think.
yeah. I mean, in my head, 2018 was like 3 weeks ago. So,
Okay. No, that's fine. That's fair.
yeah. Let's get into the time warpage that the pandemic had on us all, where I'm just like, yeah, it went on forever, but it also seemed to last for 2 days. It's bizarre, that period of time. So 1939, remade again in the 50s, and then in 94.
Yes.
About a man and a woman. It's not like it happened one night or something. No, I don't think that's. I
No,
don't
it
think.
happened.
Yeah.
No. It happened when it was 1934.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. So 39. Not a, yeah. That's about. So,
Do you want to know some of the names of the actors? Maybe that'll help.
okay.
Okay, so the original from 1939 starred Irene Dunne and Charles Boyer. Again, that's probably not going to help you.
No.
The remake starred Cary Grant and Deborah Kerr, or is it Carr? I don't know how to pronounce it.
I think I've always said
That was a
Kerr.
hint. That was a hint as to what it is. And the remake from 1994 was with Warren Beatty and Annette Bening.
Oh, wow. I was going to be Bullworth. Finally, we cracked it.
No, not Bullworth.
No, I think I think I
And there.
I think.
There is an iconic New York landmark that is the center of these movies. These characters are meant to meet at this iconic landmark.
No, I think it's not nothing's come up. I'm sure it's gonna be a really frustrating, like, oh, of course, kind of scenario. But no. It's annoying too, because it's like, oh, Warren Beatty and Annette Bening's like, oh, they're married and everything, for God's sake. It's like, why can't I remember the film they did together?
Okay, here's the biggest hint. The movie Sleepless in Seattle constantly references it.
Yeah. I was actually in my head, I was thinking Sleepless in Seattle. I was like, but that's not a remake. So,
No, it's not. Sleepless is just references it
yeah.
throughout.
No, I think I'm gonna have to throw up my hands to this one. As again,
Right, so
I know as soon as you say it, I'm gonna like, of course, but.
okay, so the original and the second remake were both called Love Affair, and
Oh.
the remake from 1957 was An Affair to Remember.
Oh, An Affair. Okay, yeah, Love Affair. I'd be still like, that's a generic title. And but An Affair to Remember, like, oh, cool. Yeah, no, An Affair to Remember. Yeah, I 100%. I do know that film. But yeah, no, sorry, man. You probably stumped me
That's okay. I wasn't trying to stump you, I was trying to help, but that's okay.
there. It's like you were literally,
All right,
I was
so.
literally giving it to you on a platter, and you couldn't take it.
All right, Niall. So, why don't you tell everyone where they can find Niall McGowan?
Yes, I am one of the hosts of Bat Minutes, which is a podcast that has been breaking down and talking about the Batman films 1 minute at a time. We've been doing it for several years now, so we're several seasons deep. And we started with the '89 film. We've gone through all the '90s Batman stuff, and we've also covered Mask of the Phantasm, which is also '90s Batman stuff. So that would have been included in my previous statement. I don't know why I felt the need to mention it again. But now, yeah, this season we're doing the Adam West movie, which it feels like I've been banging on about the fact we've been doing the Adam West movie for, like, particularly even on Movie Rob Minute. I think I've mentioned it like 3 or 4 times now. But
Yes.
that season is now actually, like, it's near ready to go. Like, we've actually, like, it's all loaded up. Well, it's not all loaded. We still have loads of it to record, but, like, it's actually, like, but it's got momentum. It's on the tracks. It's incoming. By the time this episode airs, we should have release dates and stuff like that. So if you want to hear me talking about Adam West's Batman in particular, you have that to look forward to. So yeah, that'll be coming, and that's available all good podcatchers. Also available on YouTube for free as well. So we're part of our own YouTube urinal, it turns out.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movearoundminute@moveyourob.net. So, Niall and I will be back again tomorrow for another special weekend edition. But until then, achoo!
The Zoo Night.